Move on now to the third morning worship period here at the British Columbian Camp 1984. And I wish to continue the theme in regard to communion with God on a daily basis. We closed yesterday morning, with the statement on page 363 in the book Desire of Ages, which talks about every other voice being hushed and in quietness you wait before God. And the paragraph closes with these words, and this is the effectual preparation for all who labour for God. Amid the hurrying throng and the strain of life's intense activities, the soul that is thus refreshed will be surrounded with an atmosphere of light and peace. The life will breathe out fragrance and will reveal a divine power that will reach man's hearts. Now, I'd like to develop now the final sentence or two in this paragraph, particularly by reference to the life of Jesus Christ, because his life very obviously demonstrates the truth of these words and assures us that if we will follow out the instruction in this paragraph, our lives will also be surrounded with an atmosphere of light and peace. The life will breathe out fragrance and will reveal a divine power that will reach men's hearts. That in turn reminds me of a statement in the Bible Commentary Volume 2, quoting from the victory gained by Joshua in the fall of Jericho, page 995, Volume 2 of the Bible Commentary. And this is one of the powerful definitions of faith which is given in the Spirit of Prophecy. Faith is the living power which presses through every barrier, overrides all obstacles, and plants its banner in the heart of the enemy's camp. Now, this lifts faith out of the realm of simply a belief or a confidence or a trust. It declares faith to be a living power that presses through every barrier, overrides all obstacles, and plants its banner in the heart of the enemy's camp. When we come to the principle of reaching men's hearts today, we certainly find ourselves confronted with some fearful obstacles and terrible barriers. Because the mind of the average person out in the world at the present time is not in tune with God or in tune with nature. Men have become hardened through religions that don't work, through human plans which have gone astray, through misrepresentations of God's character. Until people are not attentive to the appeals of God's Spirit, and to break down those barriers and penetrate those obstacles to reach men's hearts is no easy task today. But the effectual preparation for that kind of work is communion with God, as the statement says, and this is the effectual preparation for all who labour for God, and that applies to every single one of us, of course. Each has a task to do in the great scheme of things. Now, when Christ is upon this earth, the prejudices and disillusionment of the people was very, very severe indeed. I'd like to go back to the story of the woman at the well. This, to me, is one of the grand revelations of the power of a life of communion. This story demonstrates how God is the perfect plan maker, and when he has a polished instrument, as he had in Jesus Christ, he is able to override obstacles and penetrate barriers which otherwise would be strictly impossible. Let's talk for a few moments about the deep-seated prejudice between the Jews and the Samaritans, which was the major obstacle in Christ's encounter with this woman at the well. I turn to page 188 in the book Desire of Ages. And this is a comment on the temple at Mount Gerizim in competition with the temple at Jerusalem. The woman said, "Our fathers worshipped in this mountain." She said, "And you say that in Jerusalem is the place where men ought to worship." Just inside of Mount Gerizim, his temple was demolished, and and only the altar remained. The place of worship had been a subject of contention between Jews and Samaritans. Some of the ancestors of the latter people had once belonged to Israel, but because of their sins, the Lord suffered them to be overcome by an idolatrous nation. For many generations, they were intermingled with idolaters whose religion gradually contaminated their own. It is true they held that their idols were only to remind them of the living God, the ruler of the universe. Nevertheless, the people were led to reverence their graven images. When the temple of Jerusalem was rebuilt in the days of Ezra, the Samaritans wished to join the Jews in its erection. This privilege was refused them, and a bitter animosity sprang up between the two peoples. The Samaritans built a rival temple on Mount Gerizim. Here they worshipped in accordance with the Mosaic ritual, though they did not wholly renounce idolatry. But disasters attended them, their temple was destroyed by their enemies, and they seemed to be under a curse, yet they still clung to their traditions and their forms of worship. They would not acknowledge the temple at Jerusalem as the house of God, nor admit that the religion of the Jews was superior to their own. Now, because of this religious competition between the two rival temples, the one on Mount Gerizim, the one down in Jerusalem, and because Ezra and Nehemiah had refused to accept the offered service of the Samaritans in the rebuilding of the temple, they had developed a tremendous bitterness and barrier between these two people. It was so serious that they wouldn't even talk to each other. It was regarded as a sin for a Jew to speak to a Samaritan or vice versa. And the limit of conversation was to barter at the marketplace, to trade in the purchase of food or clothing or any other commodity. So the automatic response then, if a Jew such as Christ was to approach a Samaritan, the instant response was to pull down the shutters, erect the barriers, and retreat within oneself and go one's way without even bidding the other person good morning. Now that doesn't offer itself as a very attractive prospective mission field at all, does it? And if you can't communicate with a person, if the animosity is so bad that you can't even talk together, then how can you possibly reach out and win that soul? I mean, today things aren't that bad. You can walk down the street and talk to a Roman Catholic or a Protestant or a Mormon or a Baptist or whatever, and at least they'll communicate with you, and usually very civilly as well. And once communication is established, then of course it is possible under God's leadership to direct the conversation into that which will supply that person's need and win that soul to Christ. So today things are not so bad as they were back in the days of Jesus. Now, just the same, the Almighty Plan Maker had plans for Samaria. The apostles, of course, were completely unaware of that. When Jesus arrived at the well of Sychar about midday on that eventful day, the disciples were sent into the city or the village to buy food so they could have lunch together. They were hungry, of course, by this point of time. Let me just briefly survey the events in the life of Christ prior to this point, because this took place rather early in the ministry of Jesus. When he went to the Jordan to be baptized, he then went for 40 days into the desert where he was tempted of Satan. After he returned, and four or five disciples were joined to him, and immediately he went to Cana in Galilee where he performed the first miracle of turning the water into wine. This was followed by a few days in Capernaum, after which he returned to Jerusalem for the Passover. Now, up until this time, there had been no miracles of healing wrought in any shape or form whatsoever. The only miracle was the turning of water to wine up in Cana. In Jerusalem, he cleansed the temple of the buyers and sellers, and when they came back, they found him healing the sick, and this was the first witness we have of Christ performing miracles during his ministry. This was followed by some teaching ministry around Jerusalem and the interview with Nicodemus. Then Christ continued preaching in Judea, but this caused a rivalry between John's disciples and his own. So Christ withdrew and then headed for Galilee. But on the way to Galilee, he passed through Samaria. And that's when this story took place, at the well. Now, the things I want to notice with you in this particular story are, number one, the infinitely skillful and perfect power of God as a plan maker, and the fact that an integral or important aspect or fact in that plan making was that God had at his disposal an instrument in whom was God's power, a light that was breathing out fragrance and revealing a power which was capable of reaching men's hearts. Now, God may make all kinds of plans, but if there's no instrument to carry out the plan, then the plan, of course, is of no value. Just as you might plan, for instance, to go overseas to Europe, Australia, but if you don't have a canoe or a boat or a plane or some form of transport, you won't get there, will you? It must be the instrument to provide the fulfillment of the plan. So let's take up the story then, looking at these two aspects in particular, and the story of the woman at the well, or Christ's encounter with the woman at the well, to me is a remarkable revelation of the power of a life of communion with God. I turn then in Desire of Ages, from which we'll take the story, to page 183. The Bible reference, of course, is John chapter 4, verses 1 to 42. Now I read, On the way to Galilee, Jesus passed through Samaria. It was noon when he reached the beautiful vale of Shechem. At the opening of this valley was Jacob's well. Wearied with his journey, he sat down here to rest while his disciples went to buy food. Now this may sound very incidental. He said to his disciples, "You go and buy food, I shall rest here." Now, that may appear very incidental, but it was not. It was perfectly planned. That's how God set the whole thing up. Now, supposing that a human plan maker had been at work in this scheme, and the objective was to open a mission field in the village of Sychar, which in time would extend to other parts of Samaria. Now, so the objective, in other words, supposing there was general orders for Christ to have gone there and begun that mission campaign in Sychar. Human reasoning would have said, "It's no use sitting out here by myself at the well, there's no one out here to preach to. I'd better go to town, that's where the crowds are." Human wisdom would have said that. But as the story progresses, we'll find that that would have been the worst possible course to have taken. It would have proved to be totally futile and fruitless, whereas by Christ sitting alone at the well, he made a contact there which could not have been made any other place, and which proved to be the open door to the hearts of the men and women in the village of Sychar. So God's plan was for Christ to sit there alone while his disciples went to buy food, whereas human plan-making would have said, "Let's go to where the crowds are." And I think that we've all learned, I certainly have myself, I've learned how foolish are men's plans. Even though they look better than God's plans, they do not work as God's plans do. So I'll read further. We have now a paragraph in regard to the hostility of the Jew and the Samaritan, which reads as follows. "The Jews and the Samaritans were bitter enemies and as far as possible avoided all dealing with each other." Now there's nothing that will divide people or break up marriages like religious differences, especially if one, well, in this case, of course, neither the Jew nor the Samaritan really had the truth. The Jews had it theoretically, but they didn't have it in spiritual life and power. But the consequence was, of course, that there was this deep bitterness between them. I'll read further. "To trade with the Samaritans in case of necessity was indeed counted lawful by the rabbis, but all social intercourse with them was condemned. A Jew would not borrow from a Samaritan, nor receive a kindness, nor even a morsel of bread or a cup of water. The disciples in buying food were acting in harmony with the custom of the nation, but beyond this they did not go. To ask a favour of a Samaritan, or in any way seek to benefit them, did not enter into the thought of even Christ's disciples." Now, of course, at this point of time, these men had known Christ from maybe, just guessing, maybe 5 or 6 weeks, maybe less than that. As I just recounted a moment ago, there was only a brief interval between the baptism and this point of time. 6 weeks, perhaps, maybe a little more, maybe a little bit less than that. We're not told precisely how long Christ spent preaching in Judea. Now I read further. "As Jesus sat by the well side, he was faint from hunger and thirst. The journey since morning had been long, and now the sun of noontide beat upon him. His thirst was increased by the thought of the cool, refreshing water so near, yet inaccessible to him, for he had no rope nor water jar, and the well was deep. The lot of humanity was his, and he waited for someone to come to draw." Quite a nice little paragraph on the humanity of Jesus Christ. Now we know, of course, that when you're hungry or thirsty, you feel it so badly. But when there's food or water close by but just beyond your reach, you feel that hunger worse, don't you? Much worse. And here was Christ experiencing the same natural stimulus as we experience. Here he was thirsty. There was a water close by, and the thought of it made his thirst all the worse, which reveals the fact that he was very much a human being in the fullest sense of the word. So he sat there, and quite alone, suffering from the heat of the sun and his thirst. And as he did so, a woman of Samaria approached, and seeming unconscious of his presence, filled her pitcher with water. Now, there are some very uncharacteristic things about this woman's arrival at the well. First of all, Eastern people are very sociable, and it's a strange thing for a woman to come alone to the well. Very strange. You'd rather expect her to come in the midst of a half a dozen, maybe a dozen other women all coming to draw water at the same time, enjoying each other's company, gossiping as they would certainly have been doing, chattering and talking together. And under those circumstances, of course, if that had been the case, Christ could never have talked with her, because she had been insulated by the presence of the other people. Now, the next strange thing was she came at midday, the hottest time of the day. And the usual time for drawing water was early in the morning and late in the afternoon. Now, water carrying is a very arduous a service. When I was a boy, our water supply was, well, close to a quarter of a mile away, up a hill, and we took two kerosene tins, 5 gallons each, those old square-type tins. We punched holes in the top and, well, cut the top out and then put a wire handle in them, and sometimes a yoke across our shoulders, and we'd have to carry 10 gallons of water at a time from a distance of about a quarter of a mile. And in our house, of course, water was not wasted, as you can appreciate. Last time I was in Kenya, the African people were very nice to me and made sure I had a bath every day, which I appreciated. But my enjoyment of the bath was greatly diminished when I realised the cost of giving it to me. I found that the daughter of Brother Buka, a girl of about probably 15 years of age, an extremely strong, rugged girl, had to walk down a mountainside a good quarter of a mile, descending at least 300 to 400 feet to a spring. And there she filled this probably about a 6 or 7 gallon water jar. The jar itself was enough to break your back. And then she walked up the mountain with it. I had trouble even walking up the mountain without carrying her water pot. So I can begin to appreciate something of the hard work involved in hauling water. And yet this woman did it every day. And therefore the heat of the day was not the best time to do it. I would imagine, although I'm not told, of course, that the well was at a lower level than the village, if they walked with an empty pot downhill and a full pot back uphill. Now, there's a good reason, of course, why she came at midday alone. As we'll learn later in the story, and as we already know, of course, from our previous reading of it, she was a woman who was regarded by the village as being immoral. She'd had 5 husbands, and now she's living with a man who is not her husband. And therefore, the village, in their supposed righteousness, and I say suppose because they have not yet enjoyed the born-again Christian experience. Not that we're saying, of course, that the life she was living was a proper one, but instead of being a blessing and encouragement to her, they were condemnatory of her, and they tended to shun her, so she was a very lonely figure. And therefore she tended to avoid the rest of the population and thus chose to come to the well at a time when she was quite sure nobody else would come, which was the midday hour, the hottest hour of the day. The other women came, of course, in the early morning hours or in the late afternoon when it was cool and pleasant, and that was the customary time to come. And so as Jesus sat there and the woman approached the well, she must have felt a sense of irritation pass through her, a sense of frustration to find that at the well there was a man sitting there, a man which was worse than the woman sitting there. And when she desired to draw water in utter loneliness, he was a person there to witness her doing it. Well, this must have caused her to have closed up even more, and she approached the well with the intention of drawing water, which she did. She drew the water pot and then she turned to go, but as she turned to go, Christ spoke to her. Now let's read about that on page 183 to 184. A woman of Samaria approached and, seeming unconscious of his presence, filled her pitcher with water. As she turned to go away, Jesus asked her for a drink. Such a favour no Oriental would withhold. In the East, water was called the gift of God. To offer a drink to the thirsty traveller was held to be a duty so sacred that the Arabs of the desert would go out of their way to perform it. The hatred between the Jews and the Samaritans prevented the woman from offering a kindness to Jesus, but the Saviour was seeking to find the key to this heart. And with the tact born of divine love, he asked, not offered the favour. The offer of a kindness might have been rejected, but trust awakens trust. The King of Heaven came to this outcast soul, asking his service at her hands. He who made the ocean, who controls the waters of the great deep, who opened the springs and the channels of the earth, rested from his weariness at Jacob's well, and was dependent upon a stranger's kindness for even the gift of a drink of water. Now, Sister White here, of course, is stressing the vast disparity between Christ as the Almighty Creator and now as the humble human being who is walking this earth as we have to walk it. But I'd like to note as well as that the fact that when Jesus Christ spoke to that woman, there was in his words a power which was not present in the voice and words of an ordinary person. a person who had not spent time in communion with God as he had done. And we have to appreciate the fact, of course, that up until this point of time, now Christ was probably 30 or 31 years of age, probably still 30 years of age. Christ has spent the previous 30 years in consistent and very close communion with God. And communion has a cumulative effect. The more we do it, the more powerful we become. In other words, we don't entirely lose each day's supply. There may be a diminishing of today's supply, but there's always a residue which goes to the bank, as you might say, and so there's a building up of a person's capacities to draw life and power from God. And when we consider, of course, the capacity of Christ at the age of 12 to teach the Pharisees, the scribes and so forth in the temple, the wonderful treasures of truth, and Christ's capacity to withstand Satan in the wilderness, and his capacity to turn water to wine and to drive out the money changers and lenders, he was a man of power, of extraordinary power, a man who had been accumulating power for 30 years. Now, if Christ had been a person without that background of communion, and he'd spoken those words to the woman, they would have been just words, and she would have just tossed her head and turned her back upon him and gone. But, as we read on page 363, a few moments at the beginning of the study period, let me just revise those last couple of sentences again, page 363, without losing our place at page 184, of course. We find that this is what it says, and this is the effectual preparation for all those who labour for God. Amid the hurrying throng and the strain of life's intense activities, the soul that is thus refreshed will be surrounded with an atmosphere of light and peace. Now, as Jesus sat there, he was surrounded with an atmosphere of light and peace, and that woman felt it subconsciously, but in a very real way nonetheless. It goes on to say, the life will breathe out fragrance and will reveal a divine power that will reach men's hearts. Now, it was a divine power in Jesus Christ, obtained through hours, in fact years, spent in communion with God, that enabled him to penetrate that awesome barrier of Samaritan prejudice against him as a Jew and to arrest the attention of the woman. Now, his first task was to get her attention and to get her talking, to establish communication. And so he very quietly asked the question, would you please give me a drink? Very simple request, very easily fulfilled. And the woman was surprised, as well she might be, of course, to have Jesus Christ ask of her a drink of water. And instead of tossing her head in rejection of him and just going on her way with her back turned to him, she stopped and turned and said to him, how is it, she said, that you, being a Jew, ask drink of me, which am a woman of Samaria? Now, I believe the question goes a lot deeper than it seems to go. I believe that she was really saying, there's something about you, you arrest my attention. I perceive there's a power, there's a life there that I've never ever encountered before. There's something which draws me, there's something which interests me, there's something which commands my attention. So when she said, how is it that you, being a Jew, ask drink of me? She was really asking more than that, even though in her own mind she wasn't fully aware what she was truly asking. At this point of time, she wasn't able to really discern or to really grip what there was about Jesus Christ which commanded her attention. And I suppose you've all had this experience. You've met a person and there's something about that person that grips your attention and you're not quite sure what it is. Have you met the person before? Is there something about that person's personality? Is there a charisma there? What is it? And but there's enough awareness of the presence of something to draw you to make a closer examination. And that was the case so far as this woman was concerned. Now, we can't overstress the point because it's so important that effectual missionary work can only be accomplished when the life of God is in the soul. When Jesus came to this earth, as we read in John the 10th chapter, he said, I am come that they might have life and that they might have it more abundantly. And every day, as I read to you yesterday from education, was an outpouring of his life. We are to be, as Christ was, life givers. First of all, life receivers, and then life givers. It's a sad mistake to imagine that the arguments of truth are all that's needed to win a soul to Christ. That is a very sad mistake. I've had the experience, and I've been most interested to see it happen, where certain people have heard the message on bondage to freedom. They've heard me teach it. They've been very excited about what they've heard. And without taking time to make that their own experience, they rushed off to their local church and used a Sabbath school class or even the pulpit to present to the church Bondage to Freedom. And the people sit there and say, Amen, brother, that's very nice, we're glad to hear that, and go their way and do nothing about it. And occasionally I've had the opportunity of following to the same audience, and when I preach that message, which is my personal experience, within me is the power of that message, I get a vastly different reaction altogether. The church is suddenly polarized. There's a one side, a very few, are very happy to hear it and now really want to go and make it their experience. The other side are hostile, openly hostile to the message. And I never ever get a chance to go back to that group again. But of course I do work with the one or two who have responded to the message. And I'm very, very deeply convinced today that the success of Jesus Christ in getting that woman's attention was due to the fact that within him was the presence of God's power, that he was surrounded by an atmosphere of light and peace, and he breathed forth a fragrance which did reach her heart and caused her to stop and begin a conversation with him. And if Christ had not had that presence in him, if he had not been surrounded by an atmosphere of light and peace, then most certainly he would not have established communication and would not have succeeded in the plan which God had for him at that point of time. As we read on, of course, we'll read eventually over the next several mornings that Christ did penetrate the barriers and did enter the villages of Sychar and did establish a very fine congregation of very earnest believers in that part of the world. And it was a fantastic victory for the gospel, especially so early in the ministry of Jesus Christ. My time is gone for now, so we'll leave it at that point and we'll pick it up again tomorrow morning and carry on with the story. Let's kneel together and invite Jolene to offer our closing prayer, please.